Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugurpul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kumbameri, Nunnuckle, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the first peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. Welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Today I have in the studio with me, live in the studio, Monica Morgan, a Yorta Yorta woman who's been involved in the, a strong advocate for the rights of First Nations people for many, many years. Monica, welcome to the studio. It's great to have you live to air.
Thank you, Tiger, and I want to also say that thank you for the elders and the traditional owners for having me on their country today.
Who's your mob? I've said Yorta Yorta woman. Tell people where is Yorta Yorta country?
The Yorta Yorta country is, we're not bound by whitefellas' borders. It's straddles the Murray River up down. I'm thinking I'm in Melbourne now. Along the Murray River. It's around, my country is Shepparton, Echuca, Cummeragunga in New South Wales, what they call New South Wales now, just below Deniliquin. Beautiful country, that's where all the big Murray pine and Murray gum is, where the big cod, and we have beautiful wetlands that is the heartlands of our country, yeah.
All right. Did you grow up on the community?
Yes, I did. Well, I grew up in on New South Wales side, little town of Moama, which isn't far from Cummeragunga. Cummeragunga, of course, is a old reserve, but it was also land rights land. In the 1880s, all my elder men, ancestors, put a petition together to the state protectorate at the time and New South Wales colony and asked for land in 1883 then, our mob picked that site where we are now because it's an old camping ground and we have our burial site there, which our mob still bury today.
All right. Cummeragunga was special or different in a way because they ran, different to some of the reserves and missions, they ran farming, I think cattle. There was something special about Cummeragunga in the way that the people actually, it's a fairly large tract of land back in the early days. Tell us some of the history of Cummera.
Well, like I said, our people went through all the colonisers' bloody brutalities, shooting, raping and stealing of, our country, so that we were really on the edge of our own lands. And a self-proclaimed missionary set up a place there on Maloga, which was also traditional country of the Yorta Yorta people. And that's where our people gathered. And mainly my grandfathers were involved in going and getting my aunties and that off, out of these squatters' houses and timber cutting yards where they were. My grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, was chained and brutalised and raped at 14 and came home pregnant. So that place was a protection area, but of course you know how missionaries are. They think they've got to indoctrinate you, into their way. So our mob pulled together a petition. I think one of the good things was that there was a Mauritius, Indian fella from Mauritius who came across and stayed at Maloga and married in with our family. And he was very well educated. He was a doctor. And he was taught school. So many of the leadership, like, William Cooper and everyone that comes out of that era, were very well educated but also not educated in a white fella way, where you just be a monkey or a parrot. They were educated to be really free-thinking and very progressive in looking for rights. So again, William Cooper was one of them. They signed a petition asking for land, and that land was given over. Then our mob divided up the land into family groups, and each of the family groups run their own small farm. And we had a wharf on the edge of the Murray River, and we had the best yields of wool and the best yields of wheat in the 1800s. And, of course, what would happen then? The local farmers and everyone else, with their jealousy, as what happened with Corranderk, came in and they brought in the Act. So the New South Wales Act, Aboriginal Protectorate Act, was brought into being. The land was leased out. We were given rations to, well, not we, but our men and women were given rations then to be domestics and farm labourers. But the resistance continued, you know. In the 1930s, there was a manager that was sent down, and interestingly enough, he was at Kitchella Boys' Home, and he was brutal there. And it was just part of that process where they're found out in one spot, they go to another. So he came to Cummeragunga, and he was a drunkard, was very violent, and was siphoning off the rations, of course, so that he got the best and sold it out. And so our mob did a walk-off in 1938, and that was a very famous walk-off. Went over into New South Wales, and we had the likes of the fella Patton, and William Ferguson, a whole lot of people.
Jack Patton.
He was also related to Yorta Yorta.
Yeah.
And he came down, and he was bullied so much at that time that he was threatened with treason if he spoke up. And it's very mindful of what's going on with Bolt. Treason because he dared to speak up against the Australian government and tell the truth. So he joined the army. But our mob have had that long, continuing, you know, really staunch political activism.
Was it with these same people you're talking about, Ferguson, Patton, to name just a couple, that were involved in a petition, writing a petition back in the 30s, was it, to the King for the recognition of rights?
That was William Cooper, yes.
That was William Cooper.
William Cooper. Well, right. They attended the, prior to attending the Day of Mourning, which, you know, Pearl Gibbs and Geraldine Briggs and
Marge Tucker.
Mm. I mean, we've got some absolutely famous, Doug Nicholls were involved in that Day of Mourning. Just prior to that, William Cooper, who'd been trying his hardest to try and get the governments to understand, you know, about legitimacy of Aboriginal peoples to have their own say in their own country, to have land and have their rights upheld, put together a petition. He travelled through New South Wales, he travelled through Queensland, he went to Palm Island. I know that they were a big signers of the petition, in which he declared that Aboriginal people are existence, that he talked about the colonial system of pillaging and taking and stealing of the country, and that Aboriginal people were paupers in their own land and had a right to have their rights upheld, as well as citizenship rights. So he really came in on a true two-pronged process. That petition was presented to Parliament. I think Lyons was the very first Aboriginal person to successfully meet with the Prime Minister of Australia of that time. So, you know, that was a big accomplishment because he went there as a Yorta Yorta man, speaking as from his sovereignty and who he is as an Aboriginal man. And he met with Lyons. I think, you know, that was typical of any era. I mean, even today, they heard, they listened, they nodded their head and said, yes, what you're saying is quite correct, and it was shelved. So it was never actually given to the Queen at that time. So it's King George.
King George. One of them King Georges.
So it's still sitting there, and his great-grandson is actually trying his hardest to be able to deliver that petition to England. So if anyone out there has got the way to help Uncle Boydie,
some raw resources.
Any resources, he's really hoping that Aboriginal people would sign his petition. It's on the website of the National Times. They run an article, and there's a petition there.
Is that the Indigenous Times, the newspaper?
Yeah, National, the Indigenous one, the Indigenous National Times.
Indigenous Times, right, yep.
We'd really, you know, it's a symbolic gesture to follow through on that, yeah. So that'd be great.
So there's some real deadly sort of history, strong history.
Absolutely.
Of Cumra.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Cumra Gunja, known as Cumra.
Yep.
Yes, no, it's certainly interesting stuff. Now, more history. Recently, you were involved, well, in the last 10 years, I think it was, you were involved in the Yorta Yorta land claim, native title claim.
Yes.
Tell us about that. It was a pretty, copped a lot of flack, a lot of criticism, the way it was dealt with, the way that the authorities passed their judgment, I believe. Well, what was the outcome of your claim?
Peter Gray, who just retired from the bench, spoke very strongly about how Native Title hasn't delivered what was intended from the High Court decision at Mabo. So therefore you can't trust a government to be able to initiate legislation that reflects what the High Court delivers. He was also involved in our case, actually. But getting back to it, my mother and many of the elders had known Mabo. My mum had gone up to Townsville, had gone to Palm Island. And in the early days, you know, the 80s, when the claim was being put together, had an association, plus many of the Yorta Yorta people who worked in Townsville. We had some of the Briggses up there. They were part of the Black Murray School with Eddie, Mr. Mabo, I should say. Sorry about that. Apologies. And so when that, before the decision was handed down, Mum was, just after the decision was handed down and they were talking about what they're going to put into place, some elders, including my mum leading it, Elizabeth Morgan Hoffman, used to go down to Brian Keon Cone to try and get him to be involved in a Yorta Yorta claim.
He was a barrister
with the Mabo claim. Mm. Yes, yes, mm. The claim for Murray Island. Mm. And because we wanted to put in the same type of claim as what was put in by the Murray Islanders, right. We wanted to take it to the sovereignty level, to take it to that, you know, First Peoples level. So while we were negotiating, of course, the decision came down. We were very hopeful that then we would be able to go forward and put our claim directly to the higher courts. And it was stated, well, you know, through the state up to the high, it was stated by us that we should wait and see what the native title legislation delivered. And at that time we had the Victorian Legal Service were willing to help us through our case, you know, the original notion of going directly to the High Court, you know, through that process that Eddie Mabo had gone through, Mr. Mabo had gone through. And we were told that Victorian Legal Service were basically told they wouldn't be able to run it, that the funds were not allowable for that. So we waited till the Native Title legislation was put together, and of course we went through the whole thing watching the A team and watching the B team and, you know, the whole shenanigans that went on up in Parliament House negotiating with Paul Keating and, you know, about what this legislation would look like. I think the Greens were involved and we wanted, you know, the grassroots people. I think there wasn't an opportunity for the grassroots people, the people who are really going to feel any outcome from it, to have an informed consent about what was being discussed. That was the downfall of it, I think. I think it was rushed too quickly. We ended up with the native title legislation as we have. We mounted one of the first native title applications because it was deemed that ADSIC would be able to fund it. We then fought very hard that we didn't have a representative body over us, that we wanted to be in total control with our lawyers, which we were successful in doing. I think we were the only native title cases that ever had their own funding. Having said that is why we were going, we claimed all our sovereignty, all lands for our peoples. We claimed all waters for our people. And that's when the 10-point plan came in. After Howard came in, the 10-point plan, he came down to Echuca and he said categorically that the water would never be given under native title to white people, I mean to Aboriginal people, and particularly Yorta Yorta. At that time, we had his sidekick, of course, saying that all land would be locked up, and so put this scaremongering campaign. He was also a Member of Parliament for the Yorta Yorta country on New South Wales. So we were very much in the midst of that. We had to go through a mediation to meet the benchmark to go to... we didn't have to do an identification. It came in later. So we didn't have to prove who we were. It actually came at the time where the parties had to come to us and sit down and look at a mediated outcome. So we never had that thrust upon us. Peter Gray was actually our federal court judge for the mediation. Unfortunately, if things might have been different if he would have been our federal court judge for the case itself. Mm. We tried very, very hard, even with beekeepers, mind you, to acknowledge that we were the traditional owners of our country, that we were Yorta Yorta, and even the beekeepers couldn't acknowledge that. So 200 parties, cattlemen, you know, all these bits and pieces of people that had an interest in our land, came to the throw. Peter Gray made a speech at that time indicating that he felt absolutely dismayed that at such a level of where we came to sit at the table to talk about how we could share an interest in the land, we could not even get past that. Mm-hmm. And so he carried that right through. I mean, I've had lots of discussions with Peter through the time, and that was what he found was, you know, the absolute start of the downfall of native title that he saw.
The failing of the stakeholders to actually come to terms and have some common sense about it all, I suppose.
Yes.
Would that be fair?
Yes, absolutely. And the fact that the tribunal, the native title tribunal, had to deem that we go to court. So the fallacy was that that Yorta Yorta actually went straight to court when we actually put a lot of time and effort to look at how we can share looking after country. And of course, we had to be quite honest that cattle grazing was destroying our country.
Exactly.
The waterways were being destroyed. Timber cutting is destroying our country. So we had to be truthful and talk about how we saw it.
So you were critical of the established industries in the area.
Yes.
At the same time, trying to get a win-win outcome.
Yes, yes.
And
the status quo prevailed.
They couldn't handle that.
The status quo prevailed, and that's how it was. White fellas... process of colonisation, annexing off land, commodifying resources, held sway and still holds sway today.
And still does. All right. You did get a native title result, a determination, native title determination?
Yes, and it was a dismal determination. Unfortunately, I mean, you know, many of the lawyers came into... many of the judges came from Northern Territory and they expected Aboriginal people in the South to be the same level of knowledge about songs, dance, all those types of...
Cultural
and very important and, cultural processes. And of course, native title and what came out of the Mabo decision should have never been about whether we prove what types of... culture where we were able to maintain through colonisation. In fact, it was all about those sovereign kind of determinations that we were still on country, that we still had a structure of family system, that we still hold sway, that we own that country. We still had, you know, that self-knowledge about who we are as a people. And yes, very many of those cultural aspects were diminished because, of course, the brutalisation of what happened.
Colonisation, yeah.
But we were very strong of our identity, our kinship lines. We knew where our sites were. We knew many of our very important lines of passing along, how the kinship works, how family units work, how governance through elders should work. So, unfortunately, you know, we had three state governments, Murray-Darling Basin Commission, everyone else trying to show that we were extinguished. The judgment was that the tide of history had washed away all traces of our identity.
Yeah. Wow.
Which was, you know, ironic
that
when we were talking principally about water.
Yeah.
And he was so mean-spirited, and this is Olney, Justice Olney, in his delivery, that he actually said that it occurred before 1967 referendum. So therefore, we were not even entitled to compensation for that loss, as he stated,
yeah,
of who we were as a people and our ability to claim compensation for the annexing of our country.
All right. Must have been devastating.
Well, yeah, many of our people, unfortunately, have felt a strong feeling of injustice, myself included. It is absolute injustice by the white system. But then when you look at it, black people, our Yorta Yorta people, we never ceded our sovereignty. We were never going to cede native title anyway. And the system itself proves, I think, and every Aboriginal person should look at what happened to us. And, of course, it's had a detrimental effect on any decisions that are going to come out of native title, because they're using our very low benchmark,
right,
as a determination for people coming in to make claims on native title. And they've forced people to the negotiation table with this fear over their heads. And many of our people have negotiated native title settlements that have not been at the pure equal benefit of what it should have been.
Yeah, yeah. Monica, come to my attention this morning, a member of my staff said, oh, you hear about that the publican over in Coolgardie, over in Western Australia? I don't even know where Coolgardie is. I think it's down in the south of the state. I said, no, what happened? They said, oh, publican's phone got stolen, iPhone got stolen. Then she stuck a poster up and it's gone viral. It's been put up on Facebook and stuff. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, something or other. I don't know much about social media. I'm struggling to deal with emails these days, me. But there's a poster put up on the pub. No Indigenous person will be served. Let me see, I've got it here. Until her phone is returned and she identifies the person, names the person as well. Now, the thing is, what we've got, there's a poster. What we've got is, no Indigenous person will be served in this hotel until my Apple iPhone is returned that was stolen on Saturday 1st of March by so-and-so, and the name is blacked out. This is the 1st of March 2014, so it's only a few days ago that this happened. It's very current. But this is, it's Western Australia, and it is a publican. Where profits run pretty high, I think. I don't see any pubs running low on profits and stuff. She could probably afford to own half a dozen iPhones. But it doesn't matter. It's not the point. The fact that this poster can be put up in public and letting blackfellas know in the town, no blackfella going to be served here until so-and-so brings back my iPhone. Would she do that if it was stolen by a white man? Would she say, no whitefella served here, I'm shutting the pub down, just you blacks can come in?
Of course not.
You know? It's a bit outrageous, isn't it?
It's disgraceful. And it just really highlights that racism is alive in this country today. It's absolutely alive anywhere in Australia. And the other important thing to think about is that the collective nature they view Aboriginal people, you know, all Aboriginal people are drunkards, all Aboriginal people are this and that, and they
lazy,
put labels on all our mob.
Yeah.
Yet when you see the rhetoric of the government, who's supposed to be protecting and promoting the rights and civil rights of Aboriginal people along as, you know, every other citizen, We're individuals,
yes.
And there's no collective rights. So, you know, the contrast, that is one. I'd say if Mick Good is listening, he needs to get his mum over there right away, because this is a discriminatory act. And the fact that she names that person, that yeah. person themselves can sue her.
That's right.
Because it proves to me that she has no grounds to point the finger, because she hasn't been able to go to the police. I mean, any other person, if you get a property stolen,
that's right.
you take the individual to court, or you charge them. Mm. So it just shows to me that this woman, and it's, you know, this woman is can be replicated in nearly every bloody country town, city town, pub that you go to. My son in the middle of Melbourne, when he was sitting there waiting for his sisters to come back to have a pub, and it's, you know, uptown pub in Fitzroy that is now taken over, you know, gentrified. He was told, we don't want you here. You've got to get out of this pub. We don't serve Aboriginal people. And he said, why? He said, oh, we had trouble the other night.
All right.
So every blackfella's labelled.
Yeah.
But I don't mind every blackfella being labelled myself. I say, because one in all in. If they're going to be racist to one person, and we've all got to stand up, and we've all got to speak for them, for that mob. Yeah.
Yes, no, racism is alive and well. And I think it's gone beyond racism. I think it's apartheid. You know, we should call it what
separation.
It is a separation, clearly separation there. And, well, there's also a blog in there by the Andrew Bolt, the nutcase that was that went and tried to diminish or deny, the aboriginality of Larissa Berendt and Patty Tok and Dr. Mark McMillan and a range of other people. He's come out very critical of Adam Goods, because Adam's spoken of the pillaging, the rape, the destruction of country. And of course, Bolt's got a jump on it, and he stated that Adam has done the, where is it, this week denounced, the Swans captain denounced our very dark past, a brutal history of dispossession, theft and slaughter is how Bolt has described it. And he's not real happy, because Adam is now Australian of the Year. So Bolt jumped up on his high horse, saying that Adam, my grandparents, committed no thefts, rapes or murders. They were in Europe at the time that you claim this happened. The point there is, Monica, it doesn't matter where they were. Bolt is here today.
He's benefiting now.
From that dispossession, rapes Absolutely. And murders. Well, I mean, where is this bloke at? He's a dinosaur, obviously.
Well, he crashed and burned terribly with the discrimination case.
So you think he's still got a bad taste in his
mouth? He's run squealing, crying to the Abbott government to try and make those changes. He hasn't played ball with the judicator, has he?
Mm.
So he's questioned his own system.
Well, exactly, too.
He's questioned his own bloody system.
Yeah.
For the life of me, can't understand how a blackfella wants to accept an Australian of the Year award. But having done so, I was very proud of the fact that Adam was able to come out and he spoke very strongly and he spoke the truth. This is the history of this country, and the history of denial of this country is absolutely still with us, because we only have to see the likes of Bolt, how he comes out. We only, you know, and the racism that still happens because of what happened in Perth, you know, and happened in Western Australia with that woman. It happens on a daily basis, and I commend Goodsy, because what he's done is he's been able to fly the flag, and straight away the racists have come out of the woodwork. And what Bolt just exposes himself is the ingrained racism, the ingrained denial of how they treat Aboriginal people as separate within the country, and how they deny us being able to state our rights is it can only be a good thing, because the more that it's exposed in Australian society, the more that it brings to exposure and creates a dialogue and a discussion. Only when we can get over this racism are we going to be able to move on to those really important issues for Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people is, of course, the, you know, the questions of what happened in history and being honest, looking at the sovereignty of Aboriginal people, and, you know, because it goes with the dispossession, was an illegal dispossession. Only then can we really get to getting proper rights, equality and dignity for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that is denied to us by them bloody people, you know, the shock jocks, the ones who sit, you know, have got these glorified places in, you know, newspapers to run down and rubbish Aboriginal people.
Yeah.
We need more of people like Adam to stand up. You know, we've got a lot of Aboriginal people in very high places who are very, very silent these days. And I've really got to wonder what's going on.
Yes, no, you're right. We do have. And the other thing we have a lot of is more and more people claiming to be Aboriginal. And I'll say, oh, my grandmother, my great-grandmother's Aboriginal. Well, maybe you should bring her along to speak of her Aboriginal experience, because you cannot speak of that black experience by your great-grandmother, yet you claim to be black. Mm. I have a bit of a problem with that. We can't deny the identity of people of our mob that are claiming identity. But I think there's a couple of issues here with identity, Monica. You can claim your identity on from two ways, I suppose. One is bloodline, and the other is it's cultural. It's a heritage thing. You know what I'm saying? There are those of us that have lived black and have been told you. I was told I was black when I was 5 years old, when they saw my black mother come and get me at school. And then when I got to be 17, 18 year old, and I could stand up and say, I'm black. Oh, you know, you're just a suntanned Aussie, you know. They try to deny you that. So we've got people that can say, my great-grandmother's black. All right, but how black are you? That's sort of what comes to my mind. How black are you? Pardon me. So we've got more and more people that are coming out of the woodwork. And I think it's probably a good thing that they're coming out of the woodwork and claiming the identity. But I think a word of warning would be, just take your time. Learn the history. Live. Know what it's like for people. I mean, a couple of my daughters here, you know, they're white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. But as soon as you hear them talking, you can pick up, oh, they're Koori's, they're Murray's. They're born in Redfern. Some of them claim to be Koori's. Some of them are living up here called McLean Murray's. But I just see more and more of this stuff happening where they're ticking the box. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, yes, tick the box. And that's as black as they go.
I think the acknowledging history and past is also needs to happen amongst our own mob. My mum had a saying, and she said, there's more white fellas with black blood. More white fellas with black blood than we have white fellas with black fellas with white blood. That was her saying. Because in a street, little country town, she'd say, see the one there? That's a black one. See that one there? Our mob knew him. There was a time in history, and I'm putting aside what happened with Stolen Generations and what's happened as part of Acts, and that I set that aside because it's different for Stolen Gens, because they actually were taken from their communities and were brought up and sent out to homes, and they were really brainwashed to believe that they were white, and very many of our people are still out there. But it's amazing to me, elders always knew the ones who made the decision at some point in their history, family's history, and I have them in my own family, who said it is just too hard to live black. It is, and we're talking about, and it may well have been a survival strategy, you know. You blend in, you fall back and blend into the white society.
It's very much a survival strategy. It had to be survival.
Because the rapes and things that happened, of course, all of us
losing
have got white
kids,
blood down south.
Yeah.
Very few of us can say that we don't have white blood.
Mm.
And that's what Bolt goes on about. Mm. But that white blood was there at a price. And as the generations have gone on, yes, we in my own family I have an instance of people coming back and saying, oh, my mother or my grandmother is from your family, is an Aboriginal. I've gone through my history. And she said, I want to reconnect. And we say, that is fantastic, because we always knew that you were there and we were just waiting for you to come back. But why do you say that your grandmother and mother are Aboriginal, aren't you?
Exactly.
And so we say, the advice from our mob is you have to do your apprenticeship, because not only bloodline is important, it's the communal, it's the issues of being part of your community, being part of your family group, taking the blows, slings and arrows of outrageous fortune when it comes to living in a family, and to not only the nuclear family, but we have huge extended family. Know the place of yourself when you need to speak. Know the place of how the elders operate. Know how the family traditions run. Know when it's right to go to a place and when it's not right. Who takes you where? Unfortunately, we have a lot of our newfound identity people, and I'd call them that, newfound identity, who do all this white research about their identity but do not enough learning from their mob. And there has to be a lot more of that go on. I'd like to see us... But our mob are just so caught up with just trying to survive. Mm. Trying to teach and bring other people in can be very hard. And it's amazing the amount of people, newfound Aboriginal people, who become social workers, actually, because they want to come in and fix what they see as a problem instead of coming in and absorbing and understanding what the history
was. Fixing their own problem first.
Well, you've got to understand where Aboriginal people are today in history and in the life of Australia to understand history.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, they're coming in with that white terms of reference, white experience, white perceptions, white outlook,
there can white be that
values.
Possibility. Yeah. My family, of course, I have a white father, but my heritage, my mother's, both sides of her family, both sides of their family, were Aboriginal. Yet the ones before that were raped, women. Mm-hmm. And our bloodlines like that seems to carry on through the bloodline. Mm-hmm. And you can't always judge a book by its cover. The strongest and most staunchest Aboriginal people that I know, blackfellas that I know, actually fair ones, and down my country. Mm.
Yeah, for sure. All right. We've got a little bit of time to talk about. We might take a break for a song. I've got Bob Wilson, a First Nations man from out around Wilcannia way, singing Song with a Moral. My guest is Monica Morgan, a Yorta Yorta woman, joining me this morning for a yarn about whatever comes to mind. Bob Wilson, Song with a Moral. Talking about morals, I was just thinking, Monica, the mob that are, what do you call them, newfound identity mob. Getting the benefits of the struggle of a mob that, like your Jack Pattons and William Fergusons and William Cooper, Marge Tucker, Pearl Gibbs, and even ourselves, what we went through.
Mm.
I mean, you were here at the 10 embassies at the Commonwealth Games, 82. You got locked up with the rest of us. And there have been some gains from some of those things that have happened. But the newfound identity mob, they get the benefits of those struggles without having to go through them. But hopefully they will be aware enough now and educated enough to be able to go through some of those struggles with us, maybe.
I think we, our peoples need to sort out a way in which we are able to absorb people. We talked about the process of sovereignty and treaty yesterday, or it's coming up. And it appears to me that if we were, many of the places, of course, if we're strong in our governance structures that's based on family groups and based on principles of family, land, connection and those things, and on seniority about who is best to speak for family, who should be the leadership within the country and who should be the spokespeoples. If that was to take place, then their mob could be absorbed in there, but they would most certainly have to be Aboriginal in that context. Unfortunately, a lot of our newfound people, identity people, might congregate in outside, because outside of our communities, and before they actually learn and do their apprenticeship, are starting to voice their own opinions. And that's where it is really it's a recipe for disaster, because what you've got the people like the Bolts and that will peg them against us.
Mm-hmm.
And they will start getting disinterested in being a part of the Aboriginal community. But most certainly what's happened is that I've found with my own, and this is just me personally, but the member of the family who came forward to us was an artist. And so being able then to be identified as a Yorta Yorta person, then went on to be an artist and won some acclaimed awards, and then put in for a house. You know, got a lot of benefits. And then when they were asked to into the family group and told, you know, the way that our system operates, they've disappeared. I no longer see that family person. That person has moved into another part of the country, out of our country, has kind of disappeared. The whole family, the brothers, they all got homes. No longer are they members of the Yorta Yorta Nation, our membership. No longer do they come to our meetings and present themselves and be part of the discussions. So I don't know how often this happens, but I think, yes, they are Aboriginal people, and yes, they do have that lineage to us, and they have every right to say they're Aboriginal people, particularly Yorta Yorta, but they have no right to actually practice their... the benefits of being Yorta Yorta, because they don't comply or exist within the community. Mm. You understand?
Mm. Yes. Not a part of the community. Mm. Yeah. Yes, I think that's the difference. You can have the lineage, the heritage, the bloodline, but you also have that...
Responsibility.
The responsibility and the acceptance in community, the experience... in the community, you have all that to top it off, as opposed to someone that says, "Oh, my great-grandmother's Aboriginal." Well, who are you? What are you? How come? What's your problem? Anyway, what's your identity? You're in town to take part in our discussion yesterday on treaty. Let's Talk Treaty was on camera. The discussion about treaty, when Warren Mundine made his Australia Day speech, and Warren was at the table with us all as a panel member. He's the chair of the Abbott Government's Aboriginal Advisory, Indigenous Advisory Council. When he made his speech on Australia Day and spoke out about a treaty, that a treaty was needed, we've got to get in the path of a treaty, took me by surprise. I think it took a lot of us by surprise to hear him come out and make that statement. But in response to that, Alison Anderson, a First Nations woman in the Northern Territory, who's also a member of the Northern Territory Parliament, was critical of him and saying, look, it's too late for treaty anyway, and you're muddy in the waters for constitutional recognition discussions that have been taking place for a year or two now. What are your thoughts? Do you think the waters are muddied by talking about treaty now while the government... I think there's a difference. One main point of difference is the government. I think it's the government's driving. It's white people driving constitutional recognition, whereas treaty, it's First Nations mob driving that. But for Alison to say that it's and anybody, it doesn't matter whether it's Alison or anybody, for anybody to think it's muddying the water. Do you think it's muddying the water, or is it part and parcel of the same discussion?
It's part and parcel of the same discussion. White fellas have to get their house in order. And our mob are just, you know, those that vote are voting within the white fella system, and that's cool because we do have to live within a system. You know, we've got to go to, you know, pay our taxes, do all that stuff.
Have a driver's license and pay our traffic fines or whatever.
It's a survival mechanism. Mm. But the sovereign nature of Aboriginal people still pre-existed and continues to exist, and there is no reason why two sovereigns can't, because sovereignty is not just about borders, it is about what's happening in the country. It's about people.
Relationships.
And we are sovereign people. And so for us as sovereign people to enter into a treaty, we've got to be able to enter into a treaty with another body. And that body, of course, would be the Australian Parliament, the government, because under their Federation, which is a constitution. They guide what agreements can be made internationally with other sovereign groups. So they have a racist clause within the constitution that needs to be eradicated, and of course there needs to be some replacement with an agreement that says that they recognise. I think they have to, because if they cannot recognise the existence of Aboriginal people within their own constitution, then you know they're at failure, not us. Mm. They are. But on the treaty side of it, when we as sovereign people wish to make our place as sovereign peoples equal, sitting at a table to make that agreement, we will need to be able to talk with people that can speak on that behalf. So it's not muddying the waters, but it is a white-driven process. And, of course, we can't trust government. We've never been able to see trust in government. They've got a racial discrimination clause that's been pushed aside set aside so that they can run racist legislation such as or determination such as the Hindmarsh Island case, where they just pushed aside the women's dreaming site, you know, the Nurindjeri women. You've seen the Northern Territory intervention where they've just, you know, could run the army. I mean, yeah. If they didn't think we were sovereign, what sovereign group runs a war against their own people?
Mm.
So they don't even see us as part of the Australian society. They see us as the other. Cool. But if they're going to do those things, then they're going to have to be accountable in the future. But so you can't really trust that everything that's going to happen. I think that what should happen in the Constitution should be minimal. It shouldn't be, Blackfellas shouldn't be campaigning for everything to be in the Whitefellas Constitution. It just should be an instrument that allows us to be able to negotiate with the other side as sovereign peoples.
Yes.
There's no muddying. And I would have told you, you know, last year that I would agree with Warren Mundine, would have fallen over backwards. But I agree with Warren that there needs to be a treaty, that it's not too late, that it's the only way to be able to deal with what happened in the past and set a good foundation for the future. But in saying that, Warren, you need to step down and let the people from the ground choose their leadership.
Yeah,
so sure. If you can be a part of that process, that would be great.
Well, Monica, that's a nice good note to finish up on. We're at the end of our time. The news is approaching us. Thanks for joining us for the discussion yesterday, but for today too. It's been great just to have you in the studio and touch base with on some of these issues. Thank you very
deadly.
Much.
Hey? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Safe travels back home. And
see your mob out there.
Yes, and you'll be back at some stage again. We'll get you back on air for a yarn, as we have done in the past. You've heard Monica on Let's Talk via telephone. So you just have a great day, and don't forget your Let's Talk on your local First Nation station via the National Indigenous Radio Service. Have a great day.